would be a bat and come. We are about to have a conversation with Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, who we all know is running to become the next governor of the state of Maryland. Election is just days away on November the 4th. Lieutenant Governor, welcome. Good to have you back on the program.
Mark, it's great to be on the program again. And as we were talking about earlier, I think you interviewed me 8-9 years ago, right after O'Malley and I announced our ticket.
We did. And here you are.
Here I am.
So a couple of questions. Let's just start off with, there people have said to us over the course of the last day, actually just today, that the polls are showing this election extremely close. This is a political question, not a kind of a... So why do you think it's so close? I mean, either saying, I don't know the numbers, I haven't seen the numbers from the internal Democratic polls, but we're hearing from rumor's sake that they're extremely close. Why do you think this election is so tight in such a heavily Democratic state, given the numbers that the last governor won on?
Well, I would say that gubernatorial elections in Maryland for the last at least two decades, go back to Governor Glendenning, 1994, and with 1.2 million votes cast, he won by 5,000 or 6,000. If you look at the O'Malley-Brown effort in 06, we won by 6.8%. And even if you look at 4 years ago, in the beginning of October, right, if you remember, and listeners may remember, that race was in the margin of error. And it ended up being a 14-point, like just like sporting events. People remember the final score. They don't remember the quarter-by-quarter score. It was a competitive race. Gubernatorial elections in Maryland are competitive. So, you know, the Baltimore Sun, their poll had it at 7, and the Washington Post had it at 9. You know, these are competitive races. And, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't say the only poll that matters is Election Day. And that's the truth. You know, elections are conversations that you have with voters, and you have that conversation up until the polls close on November 4th. There's a lot of interest. I say enthusiasm, but I get challenged on that all the time. But I think there's growing enthusiasm for our message about building a better Maryland for more Marylanders. And what does that mean? It means every day fighting for work and families, middle class values, make sure that if we're delivering good schools, it's not just in some counties or some communities. If we're driving down violence in safer neighborhoods, it's not just in some neighborhoods, but it's in neighborhoods throughout the state. And people, they're listening. They know that I'm focused on business climate and strengthening our business climate so we can create more jobs. And there's growing enthusiasm for this campaign. So not complacent, but very confident that...
Complacent would be the wrong thing to
that'd
be.
Yeah, no matter where you are in the polls, you better not be complacent.
But there's clearly... something afoot with voters, and two very tough questions about this. One is, one thing your opponent pushes a lot is the question of taxes, and I think that the polls bear out that Marylanders are tired, are really taxed out. They're feeling like they're overwhelmed. Even some people I've seen interviewed, citizens in Baltimore, Prince George's County, Montgomery County, which are solid Democratic areas, are saying, "What's he going to do about all the money coming out of my paycheck? And what am I getting for all the money coming out of my paycheck?" So that is a huge issue here, and I think Mr. Hogan has been able to play on that.
Yeah, what Mr. Hogan hasn't done is he hasn't laid out sort of a vision, a plan, if you will, that will, you know, strengthen our economy, create quality of life, and do it within our means. And what I mean by that is, you know, 8 years ago, Marylanders were facing 40%. You know, a 40% hike in college tuition. We actually saw a spike in crime in Maryland 8 years ago and the years before that. And we were seeing overcrowded schools with no plan whatsoever to address that. During a very tough, so faced with that, then the economic downturn that was experienced not just in Maryland but national. You know, Marylanders did a lot to protect schools and safe neighborhoods, expand access to health care, clean environment, and the like. And Marylanders don't want to go back to those days. Now, look, you know, Mr. Hogan is good at sort of speaking to the challenge, but he's sort of hollow and there's a lot of empty rhetoric when it comes to the solutions. You know, and how do you strengthen the economy? How do you create jobs? How do you create the conditions so private sector is going to invest in jobs? And that's what the voters just have not heard from Larry Hogan. On the other hand, Ken Ullman and I, we've laid out not only a framework for strengthening our business climate, but also, you know, a proposal, a plan to create jobs. That includes investments in infrastructure like the Port of Baltimore and the Baltimore City Schools. It means a greater emphasis in and investments in education and training. That's why we talk about pre-K, career technology education, technology-ready classrooms. And also where we talk about, and this, you know, your question started out talking about taxes, I actually agree with Mr. Hogan and that Marylanders need tax relief. But where we differ is that Ken Ullman and I, our tax relief starts with small businesses that create 2 out of every 3 private sector jobs in Maryland and America. He would start with the largest corporations, small group, wealthy corporations. A lot of them are headquarters out of state that need it the least.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where, and we fundamentally disagree on how to deliver that tax relief to Marylanders.
So the basically, there are 2 questions here, and because you've talked a lot about that you're not going to raise taxes in this.
That's right.
In these next 4 years in the administration, if you win the election, but in the state of Maryland, the Board of Revenue estimates are saying, and others people are saying different numbers, but we're going to have at least a $238 million revenue shortfall. And that could get worse in the years out for lots of reasons. Not all of them under Maryland's control, but for lots of reasons, this shortfall is going to be taking place. So how can you pledge not to raise taxes when we could be facing such a kind of dire picture? No matter, I don't care if you're governor or Hogan's governor, whoever's governor is going to face this.
Because state government will do what Maryland families have been doing and what businesses have been doing, which is to live within our means.
What does that mean, though?
What does that mean? It means that our spending will equal our revenues. And there's a greater than 50%, more than 50% of the state budget. So I'm not talking about federal funds or special funds, but state operating dollars is formula driven. These are formulas that are in place that determine the level of spending. These are formulas that have been in place for decades, not some new formula of Governor O'Malley or even Governor Ehrlich or even Governor Glendening. They've been in place for a long time. And many of those funding formulas drive spending at a rate that is higher than revenues. And there's no really equivalent in a private business or even in a family, right? Your revenues are driven, obviously, by a number of factors, but it always has to be tempered by your revenue, by your revenues, your income, how much you bring in. So as a state, we'll do the same. Now, that's not suggesting that there's irresponsible spending in government, because over the last 8 years, we've cut spending by $9.1 billion, which included a lot of shaving those formulas that were driving expenditures.
But can the government find $238 to $250 million, whatever that number is, of cuts that are not going to hurt the people of Maryland raising taxes?
Keep in mind that during the last 8 years, during this recession, and we inherited a structural deficit, there were years where we approached the budget and our starting point was a $1.6 billion deficit.
I remember that.
Right, and no one wants to go back to those days, and we did a lot to eliminate that structural deficit. We made some adjustments to the formulas, achieved some efficiencies and savings in government. We need to continue building on that effort for efficiencies and savings. Ken Ullman and I rolled out a $1.5 billion savings plan that we think with, improving our procurement and, cooperative purchase agreements with local government, achieving greater efficiencies with Medicaid, our vehicle fleet, a number of other things that we can achieve over 4 years, $1.5 billion in savings. Our revenues are growing. I mean, don't think that they're not growing. I mean, our revenues are growing, plus or minus, 4%, probably a little bit more than 4%. So we've got to get our spending formulas have to be, I don't want to say informed because it's more than informed, but as a minimum informed by revenue growth. And we've got to, and that's what I mean when I say live within our means.
I guess, but it's still a pretty scary scenario thinking that we could have this deficit still growing because it's just, we have we've not put our hands around the question of state employee retirement.
And we've done some of that.
But I mean, it's a huge number we're wrestling with here when it comes to that and how we're going to take care of that.
Well, let's talk about the pension. I mean, because of the difficult decisions we've made, where now state government employees are contributing more to their pension. New employees are getting less on the when they start receiving.
And neither party's happy about that.
No, and which is sometimes a good thing. Sometimes a good thing.
Because it's a good thing that has to happen.
Well, no, it's good. It's when you say that neither party's happy. Look, if anybody walks away from the tough work we do in Annapolis very happy, then often it's a lopsided result. So we try to achieve balance. So you're paying more on the front end. You're getting less on the back end. But it was necessary in order to make sure that the pension system not only could pay benefits to current pensioners, but future pensioners. And that's why we worked with the labor force, organized labor, AFSCME, and other collective bargaining units in government to strike a balance and to find a way that we can have a sustainable long-term pension system. You no longer vest after 5 years. You now vest after 10 years in state government. That was a big change.
So I wonder what happens. I mean, I'm asking you, the man running against you, the same question when he comes to the door. Not today, but when he gets to the door here. I mean, so what happens to a Maryland and America where people can't retire anymore, where you can't afford to retire because you don't get as much coming out of the back end?
Well, look,
what happens to our world that people have expected since Roosevelt through the Kennedy years? Everything's sort of going downhill in some ways. I mean, what's our response to that?
Well, certainly as a you know, as the person, governor, who presides over the 50,000 mm-hmm. state government employees, we have an obligation to honor the retirement commitments we make. That's our pension. And again, we have gone to great lengths to ensure that we have a sustainable pension system. Definitely, there are some concerns that this legislative session, that money was taken from the pension system to pay for ongoing obligations, and
right.
I have made it very clear that we're not going to cover current obligations with against our future commitments with pension dollars. There are a number of proposals that legislators are offering for private pensions. There are proposals to establish more 401k type of programs in the private sector, work with private sector employers to make that that available. Certainly, I want to see Maryland's congressional delegation in Washington make sure that we have a strong Social Security system and that we don't move the mandatory, or I should say we don't move the retirement age to 70. That may work for someone. For some, but I can tell you for that person out there working a jackhammer, you know, in the 50s and is looking forward to retiring at age 60 or 62, and you tell that man or woman that you got to, you know, continue to, you know, work that jackhammer until age 70, they may not make it to 70. So I certainly support the congressional delegation to stay strong on Social Security.
So a couple of questions. A political question, and then I'll come back to some of the stuff you're going to face as governor. I've listened to some of your ads on the radio recently, just driving around, and turnout's going to be a huge piece here. So I wonder what part does race play in this campaign? What I mean by that is, you're clearly exhorting African Americans, who are part of the strongest base for the Democratic Party, to come out to vote in the ads. First black governor in the history of the state of Maryland, former a southern state having a black governor. And
well, that's not just the Democratic Party. But it's reported by newspapers.
Right, exactly. But then the other part is, there are some people who would argue that there are a lot of people who are not going to vote for Anthony Brown because he's black. So, I mean, I'm curious, in this whole battle over this race, how you see race playing a role in this.
Great.
What role do you see it playing?
Yeah, and I was asked that question in the third debate. I thought I was, and I'm going to
answer. I missed that debate. I'm sorry.
No, but I say that only because I want to share the same response, because the question has been asked a number of times. But I was really alarmed that after I offered my response, you know, Mr. Hogan said, well, I didn't even understand what you said. And so I think, Mark, your listeners are a little bit smarter than Mr. Hogan. So let me give it a shot again.
Go ahead.
Listen, you know, I certainly understand the historic significance of my election as Maryland's next governor. I'll be only, you know, the first African American elected governor in Maryland's history, and only the third in the history of this country. And that achievement, if you will, that result is after a long history where, you know, great Marylanders like Frederick Douglass and Harry Tubman, Thurgood Marshall, and people around this country have struggled to first secure the right to vote for African Americans, to work hard for African Americans to have a voice in the process, to have positions in government, to make achievements in the private sector, in academia. So I understand the historical significance. But where I think that race is a more relevant factor is not about me, the candidate. It's about the things that we work to improve upon everyday Maryland. And here's what I mean. We talk about quality education. Well, we have an achievement gap along racial lines where black children don't do as well as white children in our schools. That's a problem. And that's why I've put forward a proposal to eliminate the achievement gap. We're making some progress, but we need to accelerate it. When you look at health outcomes in Maryland, and we've done a lot to implement the Affordable Care Act to expand access to affordable quality health care, there's still a disparity in health outcomes along racial lines. Now, there happens to be one also along geographic lines as well. So it is significant that we eliminate disparities, health disparities along racial lines and geographic lines. So to the extent that race ever plays out in any election, it should be our collective effort to make sure that every Marylander, regardless of where your family is from or where your family lives, enjoys the same quality of life as every other Marylander.
So I have a question. I might want to come back on that, but let me switch some questions on our listeners. I want to read a couple of things people have emailed in. And these are two Lieutenant Governor, Governor questions for the administration you are about to leave come January. One is the phosphorus management tool, which you've covered a lot in this program. That was a deal that was agreed upon to kind of regulate how much phosphorus is coming off of farms, polluting the Chesapeake Bay, and how much manure farmers are allowed to put on the land. And it's a huge issue for people in the environmental movement. It's a huge issue for people in the state and for farmers. But it was a done deal. And all of a sudden, it wasn't a done deal. And then it went off the table for further study. And the study was supposed to be done a couple of days back, and it still hasn't been delivered. And so I wonder if you think, A, it was a mistake that the now governor, O'Malley, Martin O'Malley, didn't allow the PMT to go into effect when it was supposed to go into effect for the previous agreement that was cut, that changed. And B, should that agreement go into effect if you're governor, because it's going to come under your watch. This next session, if you're governor, is going to be the one you have to wrestle with that.
Sure, and look, that
was it a mistake to take it off
the
table?
Well, first of all, the second question is the more relevant question, particularly given that we're, you know, a little more than a week out of the election, and the voters want to know, you know, what is the next governor of Maryland going to do to continue promoting the efforts of protecting the health of the Chesapeake Bay and our environment, and which is critical. It's essential to the health and well-being of our families. A sound bay accounts for hundreds of businesses, tens of thousands of jobs. I think about the watermen. I think about the maritime operations at the Port of Baltimore, restaurants, the hospitality industry, tourism, both ecotourism and recreational tourism. So we have to ensure that we have a clean environment in Bay. It's essential to the quality of life in Maryland. Also, though, I'll say that, look, I support the poultry industry, which also accounts for tens of thousands of jobs. And we don't want to be in a position where we are putting on the backs or the shoulders of the poultry industry a responsibility to protect the bay and the environment that drives them out of business. That's not good for Maryland. So the next governor, as governor, I'm going to have to take the phosphorus management tool. I know there's an economic study that's being done. There's a number of programs that we have that can support the poultry industry, the farmers, like the manure transport program, which in my conversations with farmers, the program isn't as efficient and effective as it could be and it should be. So, you know, we're going to look at all of the programs. We'll look at the recommendations that come out for the phosphorus management tool, and we'll do what we do in Maryland, and we strike a balance. That's the tradition of Maryland when it comes to cleaning the environment. We will strike a balance with the ag community, the environmentalists, with local government, to make sure that we are protecting the bay and we're not driving the poultry industry out of business.
So, I mean, what does that mean? Does that mean that that the PMT as originally written you thought was wrong and that it needed to be relooked at? Or
no, I'm just laying out the framework how I would govern. You know, I mean, it's of less value for me to sort of look at what was and to comment about, you know, was it right, was it wrong, and more important to lay out a framework for what would shape or guide my approach as governor. We've got to manage phosphorus. There's no doubt about it. I mean, phosphorus is a you know, it presents grave harm and risk to the bay. Puts clean drinking water at risk. It puts, you know, and so we've got to manage that, and we've got to look at all the tools that are available to us. And if we're asking agriculture to shift from manure to commercial fertilizer, we also have to keep in mind that agriculture, that's an important service. You know, farming is not glamorous lifestyle, you know. And in fact, most people that are in farming are people who were born into farming. You don't see a whole lot of people coming into farming. It's a tough job. It's not glamorous. They feed Maryland, and quite frankly, farmers in Maryland are feeding the world. They provide a tremendous service to humanity. And if we're asking them to shift from manure-based to commercial-based fertilizer, we've got to look at the cost to the industry and the cost to us as a society and ask the larger question, how should that cost be borne by a larger society and not just on the backs of a poultry?
Right. I mean, there's some people who I know are going to reintroduce a bill this coming session about the Poultry Fair Share Act, saying that the farmers don't have to do it, but Perdue, Tyson, and the rest
should be bearing
more of the burden.
Mm-hmm.
Of.
And we'll have to look at that as well. That's right. I mean, you've got to look. You have to look at this industry wide. Absolutely.
You're listening to my interview here with Lieutenant Governor and gubernatorial candidate Anthony Brown. We hear the rest of this interview right after a very short break. And on our way to break, we're hearing Got My Mojo Working by the Great Muddy Waters. On this day in 1969, Muddy Waters was seriously injured in a car crash in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Fly Like an Eagle, Steve Miller Band. Byron Alfred of the Steve Miller Band, born on this day in 1949. Now let's get right back to my conversation with Lieutenant Governor and gubernatorial candidate Anthony Brown. So another thing here, before out of time, there are so many things to ask you, but let me just try to get through this quickly as I can here.
So you're saying you want me to be shorter in my answers?
I have to be quicker on the draw myself. I don't, the draws were the wrong thing to say. Yeah. But anyways, so... But this has dogged you throughout the campaign, and it gets asked you all the time, which has to do with the rollout of the health care plan. A lot of people are wondering why Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown hasn't just said, we screwed up. I screwed up. I was the boss. It messed up, and I'm trying to change it. But because everybody feels like you're kind of hemming and hawing, going, but it really wasn't my fault. There are all these other people out there doing it. You know, we took this system here. We're making it better. Federal government had problems. They had problems. Connecticut did good. Kentucky did good. But, I mean, shouldn't you shoulder that?
Well, it's funny, Mark. Not only did you not listen to the third debate, you didn't listen to the second debate.
I did. Actually, last night.
You
I
did.
I listened to WJLA last
but
night.
But you did listen to the two debates that I participated in the primary and probably the – I can't even count the number of press conferences we held on this. Look – you know, as I've said, everybody responsible for standing up the exchange had a responsibility, and that includes me. I've been very clear on that. And what Marylanders have asked me is sort of, you know, when they say, you know, what happened here and how, you know, what happened, right? So Maryland, like every state, even the states that were more successful, had tremendous difficulty with the technical aspects of this launch, which is more than a website. This is a system. The Health Benefits Exchange is a system. We did a lot of manual workarounds. We reorganized the project leadership, refocused vendors. We plussed up at call centers and navigators around the state, people actually answering the phone to help people work through this system. And we enrolled 411,000 Marylanders by the close of open enrollment. And today, the number is closer to 500,000 Marylanders. These are Marylanders who a year ago were priced out of the market because a family member had a pre-existing condition. These are families that can keep their kids on now to age 26. So as I travel around the state, what I hear from Marylanders is, you know, that was a rocky start. But what we're looking for in leaders are people who are going to stay in there and get it done, because there's a lot of unknown out there that any governor is going to face. And there's, you know, and whether it's a health benefits exchange or any number of other things that could possibly happen. And or do we have someone who's going to stay in there, get it done, and not join those who are on the sidelines? And quite frankly, many have stood on the sidelines sort of criticizing for political gain. Having said all of that, let me just say, sometimes I'm asked the question, what's your biggest disappointment on the campaign? And you know what the biggest disappointment is? I have not been asked a single question in a debate or an interview or anywhere else about health care beyond the exchange, the good things that are happening in Maryland and the next hills that we have to take, like the global a payment system with hospitals. How do we incentivize hospitals to provide even better care at a lower cost? Patient-centered medical homes, health disparities. What are we doing to address health disparities? And that has been really the victim, in a sense, of the campaign conversation. We haven't had meaningful discussions. And the next governor is going to have to take those issues on.
Well, if you're governor, then we'll ask you that at the Annapolis Summit when we have it on the 15th
That's
of January.
That's right. I'm looking forward to that. That's right.
But two quick things. I know you got to run. One is, you know, one of the things that comes up all the time in these debates is that Maryland has the second highest rate of foreclosures in the country. Actually, I looked it up. It's third, not second. But so the question is, not that it doesn't exist, what do you do about it? I've asked the same question about the man who may become Attorney General, Brian Frosch, who plans to kind of go after banks and other places that are not doing the right thing. But what do you as governor do about the fact that so many working people, especially black working folks in Prince George's County and Baltimore City, are victims of losing their homes? What does the next governor do about that?
Sure. Look, we passed some reform measures about 4 or 5 years ago, giving homeowners greater protections. The Washington Post characterized it as the most sweeping foreclosure reforms in the nation. And then 2 years after that, in Maryland, we required mandatory mediation. We said basically to banks, if you can get on the phone and take an application from someone to put them into a home, you need to sit across the table with them in mediation before you try to get them out of the home. In the Attorney General, under Attorney General Gantzler, and we talked more about this during the primary, Attorney General Gantzler, he had a task force, and one of the recommendations of the task force is we need to put more resources in mediation. We have now a process, and I think Brian Frosch, as the next Attorney General, will take up this recommendation. We have a process where homeowners can sit across the table from a bank and be in a meaningful conversation, not sitting on the phone for 2.5 hours listening to a recording and hoping they get through to somebody. But what happens is that often these homeowners come to mediation and they don't have the support to mediate effectively, whether it's legal support or any other type of homeowner counseling. The recommendation was to invest more in that, and that's what we need to do. We gave them the tools, but now we need to kind of give them a little bit more to use those tools.
Now, I know you got to run, so this is the very last question. That there's going to be legislation coming up in the next state legislature that police officers should wear cameras. The Baltimore City Police are under investigation. Other police departments are being looked at as well in the state of Maryland locally. The question of how police relate to the community is a huge question in the state, in the black community especially. So do you think police officers should wear cameras, and should we be instituting things like civilian review boards in the state of Maryland?
Right. So on the cameras, I think we ought to pilot it. And I think that we ought to use technology as widely as possible. And we certainly don't want technology to interfere with good policing, but I think that there would actually be two benefits to the use of cameras. One, it would give greater confidence in the community. That the interaction that and which is sometimes a difficult interaction between the police and the community, that there's an opportunity to review that. I think the community would have greater confidence. But I also think it would be a benefit to law enforcement because you can now go back and look what's working, what's not working for training purposes, for professional development purposes, and I think it'll prove to be the a small minority. You know, the bad actors that aren't doing it right and ought perhaps not be on the street. But I think that we ought to be using technology to improve the way that we do everything, and that includes law enforcement.
Let you go. You know, I got to run. So, I mean, civilian review boards, yes, no?
Yeah, look, civilian review boards, again, that's part of the accountability, citizen involvement, greater confidence in law enforcement. I think it results in a stronger bond between community and law enforcement. So civilian review boards have been around, but they need to be, you know, they need to be adequate.
Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, good to have you with us. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks, Mark.
Good luck on November 4th.
Thank you.